Modern medicine has made tremendous leaps, especially in the United States. But some religions do not permit believers to take advantage of the range of medical options available. Instead, the faithful are required to rely on the power of belief and prayer, hoping that illness will be cured. This practice sometimes leads to fatal results.
Christian Science teaches that all disease is mentally caused, morally caused, and in the case of a little child, they believe that it's caused by the sins of his parents.
On this week's Eastern Standard, religious belief versus modern medicine. We're interested in hearing your questions, comments, and personal stories on this topic. Are you a believer in faith healing? Are you a skeptic? Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post your comment on the WEKU Facebook page. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. In a little while, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen. In 1977, 16-month-old Matthew Swan died of bacterial meningitis. His parents, Rita and Doug, were both members of the Christian Science Church at the time. A church has strict regulations or beliefs on when followers are allowed to seek out medical intervention. Rita Swan and her husband have since left the church, and in the following years, Rita has become an advocate for the protection of children as well as an opponent of religious exemptions from child health and safety laws. Rita Swan's story is explored in a new book by Dr. Paul Offit, Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And on today's Eastern Standard, Dr. Offit, Rita Swan, will be with us, as well as University of Kentucky bioethics professor Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, to discuss this controversial topic. Welcome, Rita Swan. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And Dr. Rosenthal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Both,
nice to be here.
Both Rita and Dr. Rosenthal are with me in the studio. And Dr. Paul Offit is on the line by Skype today. Dr. Offit is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, as well as author of Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Science. Dr. Offit, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
I want to point out, and our producer Richard Turner did a lot of work in advance of this program so we could properly prepare and have a balanced discussion. We contacted the Christian Science Church, central headquarters, the leadership of the Christian Science Church, and they declined to participate in our program. However, Martha Risner of the Christian Science Committee on Publication for Kentucky left us a message. And the message was, health care is a private, individual, or family decision in which the church plays no role. Rita Swan, before we get to Dr. Offit, I assume you have an opinion about that statement from the Christian Science Church.
Yes, I have certainly heard that before. It's always the church's justification. They say that, these are all our beliefs, but we don't take any responsibility if our members believe them and act on them.
Dr. Paul Offit, let's talk about your book, Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Again, Rita Swan is a central character, I guess, really part of the very outline of the story that you put together. Tell us the purpose and what this book is intended to communicate.
Well, I guess the impetus for the book was having lived through the 1991 measles epidemic in Philadelphia, an epidemic that involved 1,400 people and killed 9 children. That epidemic centered on 2 fundamentalist churches, both of which not only didn't believe in vaccines, but didn't believe in medical care. And I guess it was really frustrating to watch, all the children that suffered this and the children that died from this. And the most frustrating part was watching how both public health officials and legal authorities in our city both basically stood back, out of respect for religion. They just didn't do anything. I guess the summation of the book is that I think when you put your child in harm's way unnecessarily in the name of God, that it's not a religious act and it shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion, even though it often is.
To what extent are religions protected by federal, state, local laws? And where do you see a need for a change in those protections?
Well, virtually every state. I think this is, Rita can, knows this better than me, but virtually every state, I think it's 44 states in the union, have religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws. I mean, something that on its face makes absolutely no sense. If it's child abuse and neglect, how can that be religion? Religion, if it, it seems to me, if anything, teaches you to care about your children, to care about your community. And I don't see how we've come to that point where we let parents, you know, knowingly medically neglect their children. And when they say religion, everybody stands back and does nothing.
You cite many examples of faith healing and practices that you consider harmful to children. That are allowed, encouraged by religious organizations, and certainly the Christian Science church that Rita and her husband belong to is one that you mentioned. You mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, mainstream practices like exorcism in the Roman Catholic Church, religious circumcision in Judaism. How pervasive in our society are practices that are harmful, that are endorsed or actually carried out by religion?
Well, there are about 25 faith-healing sects in the United States. Christian Science is probably the best known. And most of these groups are insular. You know, what goes on in those communities often isn't known. I think that's what makes the work of Rita Swann so important. She, you know, years ago tried to answer that question, just how pervasive is this? How many children are dying each year because their parents are choosing not to give them insulin for diabetes or choosing not to give them antibiotics for meningitis? I think it's sort of this really dirty little secret. It's something that goes on in our society that we choose not to think about, choose not to know about, and basically no one stands up for these children. You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, if you're an African American and you feel that you're being discriminated against, there are groups that you can go to. Similarly, if you're Jewish and you feel that you're being discriminated against, there's the Anti-Defamation League. If you're a woman and you feel that, you know, you're not getting equal pay for equal work, you know, you can go to groups like the National Organization of Women. But if you're a child, it's assumed that your parents represent your best interests, and that's not always true. And then what happens? I think in a reasonable world, the state would step in, but that often doesn't happen.
Very soon we'll hear Rita Swann's story of the tragic death of her 16-month-old son. Can you give us some additional examples of such practices that you have found to be so abhorrent? Certainly you mentioned the 1991 measles epidemic, but what about other, you know, day-to-day practices occurring in churches today?
Sure, not just churches. I mean, I live in the Northeast, and, you know, both in Brooklyn, New York, and Lakewood, New Jersey, and Pikesville, Maryland, there are large groups of Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, whose circumcision practice is different than most, which is to say that it's the technical term is mitzitza v'peh, whereby the moil, the person who does the ritual circumcision, after they make the cut, instead of cleaning off that open wound with, you know, with sterile gauze, they suck the blood off with their mouth, and that can introduce herpes simplex virus, which is a virus can then travel to the brain and cause permanent brain damage or cause systemic disease that can result in fatalities, which has happened. There are about 17 children who have had either permanent brain damage or died from that procedure, and we do nothing. We just let it happen, and I don't understand that. I really don't understand it. I feel like it's sort of an emperor's new clothes moment. Doesn't anybody see that this is going on and see how awful this is? And that happens. There's tens of thousands of those procedures that are performed every year in the United States.
How does all of this cause you to feel about religion in general? These circumstances that you've come upon through experience or research caused you to have skepticism about religion itself?
No, interestingly, and I think Rita actually is probably the reason for that. Rita remains a religious person, and I think when I first started writing this book, I thought I would do this sort of same thing Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins did, which is take on the notion that religion is illogical and potentially harmful. But I guess as I read through the Old and especially the New Testament, I didn't come to that conclusion. I think that religion teaches us to find that best part of ourselves. I mean, to be able to be humane and not to use, frankly, religion as a shield to express some of the worst parts of ourselves. And in this case, it's ignorance of medicine. I just don't think that's a religious act. Unfortunately, the law doesn't define religion. But I guess, you know, when you write a book, you can. And so my feeling is that these just aren't religious acts and shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion.
many religions have at their basis a belief that God can heal directly. Do you believe in faith healing?
Well, no. I mean, I certainly believe that if people want to pray because pray to their God is to try and help then their child be better, I think that's fine. But I say pray and give the antibiotics. Pray and give the insulin for diabetes. Don't just put it all in the hands of God, because God, if you argue that we are created in God's image, that image included a brain. As you know, as Galileo said, I can't believe the same God that granted us sense, reason, and intellect also intended us to forgo their use. So, you know, we are the product of God, and we have made these wonderful things that have made us be able to live longer, better, happier, healthier lives. So don't ignore it. And it's also a little inconsistent. I mean, these groups will also, you know, use, for example, pasteurized milk, or they'll use refrigeration. You know, there's a number of scientific advances that these groups take advantage of, but they choose not to do others, which can be life-saving.
Dr. Paul Offit, your book is full of examples of abuses, of religion that is harmful to children. Are there examples of religion and medicine working together that you would hold up as things that we should all see and emulate?
Sure. I think, you know, a large number of the health maintenance systems, health systems in the United States are Catholic health systems. I mean, if you look at people like Albert Schweitzer in Africa or Edward Bliss in China, they, as missionaries in the name of Jesus, they brought modern medicine to the four corners of the earth. The, you know, early monasteries, you know, which had inpatient and outpatient facilities in many ways, served as a prototype for modern-day hospitals. So there's an intimate association between certainly, you know, Christianity and modern medicine, and similarly with Judaism. I mean, Judaism, if anything, really does stand up very much for health. So I think these are contradictions that we allow in the name of religion and just wrongly.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our topic on this week's program, religious belief and modern medicine, the conflict that can exist in some circumstances. Dr. Paul Offit is with us. He is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and author of Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Science. In just a few moments, we're going to get to know Rita Swan. Rita is president of Children's Healthcare, is a legal duty child, and former Christian Scientist. And we're going to ask her to tell her story. We're interested in hearing from you, our listeners. Do you believe in faith healing? Are you a skeptic about faith healing or the role of religion and the potential harm for children, especially, that could be caused by religion? We're interested in your opinion, your stories, your questions on this topic. Please feel free to write to us right now, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. You can send a tweet at WEKUEST or post on the WEKU Facebook page, or go ahead and pick up the phone. It'll be a while before we get some callers on the air, but we'd be glad to talk with you with your questions, your comments, and your stories at 800-621-8890. It's Eastern Standard. We're talking about the potential conflict between religious belief and medical science, and we're interested in hearing from you. Again, 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard, @gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. The conflict between religion and medical science on this week's program. Our phone number, 800-621-8890. You can send us an email, weku eastern standard@gmail.com. I'm John Hingsbergen, and on the phone line, we have Dr. Paul Offit, who has written the book Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Science. And one of the major characters in this book is Rita Swan of Lexington. Rita is president of Children's Healthcare, is a legal duty child, is the acronym, and she's a former Christian Scientist. In 1977, her son Matthew died due to complications of bacterial meningitis. Rita and her husband Doug were members of the Christian Science faith at the time, and it has strict rules about when, if ever, members of the church can access medicine. Rita and her husband are, I'm told, the only members of the church who have lost a child and have come forward in this public manner. Rita?
Yes, we have been meeting the public since 1979, talking about the loss of our son and the public policy needs. And we are still the only ex-Christian Scientist in the country who will voluntarily talk about the loss of a child.
And Rita, let's talk about how this all evolved for you to become so publicly involved in this issue. First, we certainly want to hear the story of how Matthew died, but as a result of his death, you and Doug together, what, decided that you were just going to do something positive as a result?
Yes, and it took quite a while to get the press to even be willing to cover it. 1979 was the International Year of the Child, and I said to myself on January 1st, I'm going to do something every day to try to bring this issue to public attention. Up until that time, I had approached newspapers who absolutely would not cover the story. And so during 1979, I did something every day, and it wasn't until October when I tried television that we were invited on the Phil Donahue program, and he gave us a whole hour on national television. And after that, we had plenty of media coverage, and newspapers would come back to us and say, oh, if Donahue does it, then it's a story.
So it's 1977. Matthew is 16 months old. Tell us what happened.
Well, my husband Douglas and I were lifelong devout Christian Scientists until 1977. Our son Matthew had had terrible fevers, and the first three times that he had these terrible fevers, we would call these Christian Science practitioners, that's the church's name for their faith healers, and they would give him their treatments, and these treatments are a special argumentative form of prayer, arguing that God is good, God did not make disease, and therefore disease is unreal. And the first three times, he did recover, and we believed that Christian Science had healed him, and we had seen what we thought were healings in the past through our faith. But a month later, he had his fourth terrible fever, and we turned to the Christian Science practitioner again. Christian Science and the charismatic faith healing sects simply don't believe that disease is caused by bacteria, viruses, insulin deficiency. They believe that it is mentally caused, morally caused. It indicates separation from God, and you just have to purify your thought and have more faith to get a healing.
An actual denial of the science behind the cause of disease.
Oh, yes. Yes, they absolutely do not believe that disease has a biochemical cause. They believe all disease is the product of your wrong thinking. And as it said in the intro, in the case of a little child, they believe the disease is caused by the sins or fears of his parents. And so these practitioners kept making more demands on us. They blamed our fear. They blamed an argument with my dad. They presented themselves as authority figures who had handled many cases like our babies. They told us that our, quote, false parental thought was interfering with their work. And this practitioner would come and see Matthew lying on the couch, and she would say to him, Matthew, you can't be sick, and essentially arguing this 15-month-old baby out of his disease and telling him that there was no false parental thought that could interfere with their work, and telling us not to even pray for our own baby because that would confuse Matthew if there were more than one person trying to address his thought. We felt helpless. We felt like we were just tied down watching our baby suffer and unable to do anything about it.
Did it cross your mind that we can just go to the hospital and take the child?
We We did think of that, and on the ninth day of his illness, we told the practitioner that we wanted to go to a doctor, and she pointed out that she could not give Matthew prayer treatments if we did. The church teaches that medical science and Christian science are so antithetical that you cannot have both together, except for a very few specific exceptions that the founder, Mary Baker Eddy, used herself.
So the hold on the mind of the believers is really, really something that most of us who don't know Christian science cannot understand. The feeling, the turmoil that you felt about whether to seek outside medical help.
Yes. It's really a massive mind control. I mean, Christian science teaches that you can control reality by how you think about it. And so when your baby is sick, you're just desperately trying to purify your thought, get rid of the negative thoughts, get rid of the fears, the doubts. You have to have faith in order to get a healing.
And you and your husband are both PhDs, not in medicine, obviously.
No.
and Dr. Offit points out in his book that you were ignorant of the medical causes of
yes,
the disease?
Yes. I had a PhD in Shelley's poetry, and my husband had a PhD in mathematics. He knew an awful lot about multivariable Fourier analysis, but we did not know that a fever was a sign of an infection. And we had actively avoided medical knowledge. My bachelor's degree required a course in biology, and I deliberately chose a 2-credit course in nature study and made leaf collections and butterfly collections, and that was the extent of my exposure to biology. The Christian Science Church tells parents to seek religious exemptions from studying about disease in school. They really believe that knowledge of disease causes disease, and even getting a medical diagnosis violates the theology, because Christian science is saying disease is unreal. And so if you get information about disease, that'll make you more afraid and more afraid the disease is real. And so you have no rational information to make a decision with. On the 12th day of his illness, the practitioner told us Matthew might have a broken bone and that Christian science allows you to go to a doctor for setting broken bones. And suddenly there was a way, we thought, that we could get medical care and also have her prayer treatments for our baby. We immediately drove to a hospital where the disease was diagnosed as meningitis. She was furious when she found out we had gone to the hospital, and she said, well, I didn't tell you could do that. You could have just gone to an X-ray clinic and just had him checked for a broken bone and not told them about the fever and all this other stuff. And she said, well, I always knew you didn't have enough faith, and she refused to pray for Matthew. He lived for a week in intensive care in the hospital and then died, and I tried different practitioners to get them to pray for him, and they refused because he was getting drugs and later because he was on a respirator. We left Christian Science right after his death.
And so his life ended under medical care that was futile at that point. It was just impossible to reverse the process.
Yes.
Well, it's such a sad story, Rita, and it's the way you have taken to approach this and tell the story to encourage change in our society is really admirable. So what have, you know, since the Phil Donahue show, and I know Dr. Offit's book is not the only publication that mentions your story, what has changed since 1977 in terms of religious exemptions for, as Dr. Offit describes it, child abuse and neglect?
Well, we've certainly made the public much more aware of this issue of faith-based medical neglect, and we have worked for legislative change. That's kind of our main focus. We believe that if we could just change the religious exemption laws to be neutral so that all parents would have the same legal duty to get their child to a doctor regardless of their religious beliefs, that would be our contribution to the issue. So I've testified before state legislatures and before the United States Senate several times, and actually only one time to the Congress, and that was just a staff meeting. But we have gotten religious exemptions repealed in several states. We've stopped the Christian Science Church from getting more religious exemptions. And we have saved the lives of children, not in proportion to our effort, but we have had several victories.
This would be a good time for me to once again point out that before our program, we reached out to the Christian Science Church, and the church declined to participate. However, Martha Risner of the Christian Science Committee on Publication for Kentucky made a statement saying health care is a private individual or family decision in which the church plays no role. Dr. Paul Offit is the author of Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Dr. Offit, how did you first learn of Rita Swann, and why did you choose to tell her story in your book?
Well, I think she's unique in that when she basically watched her son die over a period of 12 days, I mean, unlike most faith healers, she didn't just stand back and say, this is God's will. She said, at some level, I did this. Me and my husband did this. We let this happen. And then proceeded to, she took responsibility for it. That's a very, very brave thing to do. It's hard enough, I think, I work in a hospital. It's hard enough to watch parents lose their children. But the notion that you may have been directly responsible for that is just the hardest thing in the world. And she was brave enough not only to do that, but to try and spend then the last three decades of her life trying to make sure other parents couldn't get away with what she was able to get away with, and therefore she lives this every day. And I think there's, frankly, never a peace for Rita, and she can speak better to this than I can, but, you know, this is, I think she's trying at some level to fill an unfillable hole, and I just really respect that. Plus, I think, you know, she remains a very religious woman, because she's able to separate those two things out.
You know, and that's what I do want to ask Rita to tell us about. I mean, after your exit from Christian Science, when and how did you finally decide that church was still an option in your life?
When Matthew was still alive in the hospital and the Christian Science practitioners refused to pray for him, we just felt, this is not Christian, and we must try to find someone who will. And so we started calling other churches at random, and we came upon a woman on a United Church of Christ crisis line who was very comforting, and we went to her church on Sunday. We stood up in front of the whole congregation and asked them to pray for our baby. We went to that church afterwards and eventually joined it, although the Christian Science Church did not make it easy for us to get out.
Didn't make it easy for you to get out? I mean, how is that? I mean, they have no place to lock you up, do they?
No. But the members, the local church members were calling us frequently and telling us that we were too confused and stressed out to make a major decision like that, to leave their church.
So they really wanted you to remain with the church, to keep you in the community.
Oh, yes, and they used fear, too. They said that we would be at the doctor's office every day if we left Christian Science. And they told us stories about other Christian Scientists who had lost children, and it just was an impetus for them to move higher in their faith. They said that the public relations manager for the Christian Science Church in Michigan had lost his son, and he came to a church meeting the very day his son died and didn't even tell the other church members about it, as if that was behavior to be emulated.
Wow. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Rita Swann is here with us, as well as Dr. Paul Offit. And we want to draw into the conversation now Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal, Ph.D., is professor at the University of Kentucky and director and professor of the U.K. Program for Bioethics. She's the author of over 50 publications, has served as the bioethicist on numerous clinical practice guidelines, and is chair of the University of Kentucky Medical Center's Hospital Ethics Committee. Dr. Rosenthal also directs the Clinical Ethics Consult Service. Dr. Rosenthal, medical ethics, bioethics, is there some relationship or some involvement or concern about faith healing within that whole field of bioethics?
Yeah, so the way that we normally deal with a lot of these cases, and I want to point out that medical refusals, when parents refuse medical treatment for their children, it's not always based on some organized religion. It's often based on notions that they want natural therapies. They have an aversion. So that's, you know, that's a lot of the anti-vaccine movement is based on that. They want something natural. They want herbs. They don't trust medicine. So there's a lot of different reasons why parents refuse. So usually when we're dealing in a pediatric context, what we always look at, it's often case-based, and usually if the medical refusal is something that, you know, if the child can certainly be treated and certainly benefit from a treatment and the parents are refusing, then we usually look at a framework that we call the harm principle, in which this is a sort of a bioethics or theoretical framework that's used for state intervention. And so we would basically look at the case. We would direct the healthcare team to involve Child Protective Services. And as a clinical ethicist, I don't have the hospital doesn't have the authority to remove parental decision making, but we do have the authority to involve the state.
So at what point? So a parent brings a child, the child is admitted to the UK medical center, and there would arise a situation where the parent may say, nope, you may not treat our child because our religion doesn't allow it. What about blood transfusions and other procedures?
So for situations with Jehovah's Witnesses, for that situation, it's actually fairly clear cut. We usually notify our legal office. They immediately get a court order to treat. And there are actually several Jehovah's Witness parents that want us to do that because they don't want to be put in a position to even make that decision.
It absolves them of the responsibility.
Exactly. It absolves them of the responsibility.
Rita's nodding enthusiastically.
Right.
To that. Yeah.
So those are more the straightforward cases are the cases in which the medical treatment is clearly going to be of benefit. And that's when we can usually call on the state. There are cases that are not so clear cut that Dr. Offit may, you know, be aware of. And these would be cases, for example, where we may have children who are a little bit older. Maybe they're preteens. Maybe they've decided for themselves, based on either their parents' religion or their own beliefs, that they don't want to have chemotherapy anymore for their for their leukemia.
And these become more complicated. We will try to come back to that. We also want to come back and interact with listeners. So this is Eastern Standard. We're discussing the potential conflict between religious belief and modern medicine. 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. Michelle is on the line from Versailles. We hope that she is still there because we will talk to her in the next segment of the program. That number once again, 800-621-8890. Email wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. Our guests in the studio, Rita Swan, Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, and on the line, Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit is the author of Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Science. Rita is featured, Modern Medicine. That is, thank you, Rita, for correcting me here. Rita is featured in Dr. Offit's book, and in other publications, and was on the Phil Donahue show many years back on this whole issue of having been believers, members of Christian Science, she and her husband, and they lost their son, Matthew, at the age of 16 months. Dr. Sarah Rosenthal at the University of Kentucky is chair of the University of Kentucky Medical Center's Hospital Ethics Committee. And let's pick up very briefly before we go to the phone at 800-621-8890. Very briefly, you were talking about some cases with adolescents and so forth become more complicated.
Right. So generally when we determine whether or not a patient actually has the autonomy to make decisions, we look at whether they have decision-making capacity. And very often in adolescent cases, I mean, you may be looking at a 16 or 17-year-old who is making a decision that particularly in cases where they are in remission from a primary cancer therapy, they might have had several rounds of chemotherapy, they're doing well, and then they decide they don't want to have their adjuvant chemotherapy, which is sort of the therapy that ensures that they will have a better chance of not relapsing. So a really common frustrating problem in adolescent medicine would be teenagers deciding that they don't want to do this anymore. And we have heard teenagers give reasons based on religion. God spoke to me and told me I was healed. I don't believe in this. I want more natural therapy. So there's...
At what point would you accept that if it were an adult? There's an age, I imagine, where you make that decision?
Well, the age of we consider an adult competent when an emancipated adult at age 18 or if they graduate high school, whichever comes first. And ultimately, there is no age of assent. In other words, we look for, when you're talking to teenagers, they may actually have the level of capacity of an adult or even higher. So we actually look at whether we think they can make these decisions, and we look at the basis of the decision. But there are cases where the treatment may not have a clear-cut benefit. Chemotherapy has side effects. And so that's where you may hear a lot of cases in the news where the courts may be siding with the parents and the family. And I believe Dr. Offit has made, a reference in his book to some of these cases where they say, well, there are risks and side effects to chemotherapy, particularly in situations where there's no evidence of disease because they're in remission. So, one of the most famous cases was the Billy Best case several years ago that Dr. Offit may be familiar with or Rita may be familiar with. That's a case where a 16-year-old ran away from home because he didn't want to do chemotherapy anymore and is totally into natural treatment. So that's, so there's a lot of issues there. But religious beliefs, sometimes we have to look at it on a continuum of quality of life statements. What's the difference between someone who says, I have heard the word of God and they've told me I'm healed, versus someone who says, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm tired.
Let's go to our listeners. This is Eastern Standard. Our program is an interactive program, and we do want to thank Michelle from Versailles for staying on the line with us, and hopefully she's still there. Michelle, you are on the air with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, Rita Swan, and Dr. Paul Offit. Please go ahead with your question or your comment.
Hi, yes. I was just calling. First, I wanted to say, Rita, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. That's just awful, and I'm glad that you're using that to benefit other people.
Thank you.
I'm not from here. I'm from St. Louis. I didn't grow up in a religious family. My parents raised us purposely that way because they didn't like the, hold that a religion had on some people. I get that it is beneficial for some, but like Dr. Paul Offit said, God gave us a brain and we should use it. I just wanted to comment and say, not being from here and not being very religious myself, I am spiritual. I have a 6-month-old son, and we chose not to circumcise him based on the numerous research that we did. And the first question anybody asked us was, did you circumcise? And just the fact that, people don't use their brains and, go outside of what they're told to find the, at least a balance, as far as medical and scientific stuff goes, it's just shocking to me how many people will put their hands up and just say it's in God's hands when there's so much more that could be done. So I just wanted to comment on the fact that, it's incredible to me that that happens, and I'm, relieved to hear that at least there are people within the church trying to enlighten others and let them know that, hey, it's not, it doesn't have to be that way. It's just, it's shocking to me that people will choose religion over, facts and science when it doesn't need to be that way.
All right,
so
Michelle.
I just wanted to say say that.
Thank you so much for saying that. Thank you for calling Eastern Standard. And we're going to ask Dr. Paul Offit this issue of circumcision, of relatively accepted medical practice in Western society today, aside from the as you describe, unhealthful practice in some members of Judaism, does circumcision and the choice to circumcise or not fall into this category of decisions, medical decisions that could be harmful to children?
Well, the data suggests that if you're a circumcised male as compared to an uncircumcised male, the circumcised male is less likely to get bacterial urinary tract infections, less likely to acquire human immunodeficiency virus or the AIDS virus, and less likely to be infected with human papillomavirus or HPV. So, I mean, there are data to support the notion that circumcision is a more healthful thing to do, which is why the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends it. But, you know, I don't think it's an unreasonable choice by a parent to choose not to circumcise their child, but that's where that recommendation comes from.
Okay, excellent. This is Eastern Standard. Our phone number, 800-621-8890. You're welcome to send us an email, but sometimes this late in the show, it may not get to us on time. So if you really want to get your comment on the air, give us a call. But you are certainly welcome to write WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. That phone number again, 800-621-8890. And let's talk to Rick from Winchester. Rick, you are on the air with Dr. Offit, with Dr. Rosenthal, and Dr. Rita Swan. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead, Rick.
Okay. Thank you. Say, I am a hospital administrator, and I take issue with the inclusion of Seventh-day Adventist Church in your opening comment. After the Catholic Church, the Adventist Church has the largest network of hospitals in the United States, including some very noted healthcare practitioners. They have absolutely no restrictions on health care. We practice all modalities in our health care. We have excellent medical schools all the way across the nation and excellent physicians, including Dr. Ben Carson. And I just wanted to make that issue clear that we're not part of this group.
Okay, Dr. Offit or Dr. Rosenthal?
Well, I guess I'll start and then turn over to Sarah. There certainly are examples where in a Catholic healthcare system, for example, that abortions are, to say the least, not encouraged. And you know, I use a couple examples in our book, or in the book that I wrote, one in Arizona, another example in Ireland, where, you know, women were either denied an abortion or delayed to have an abortion, which ultimately resulted in death, because it was going to be, you were going to either have the choice of saving one life, i.e. the mother's life, or saving no lives. And I think, so I think there are examples, certainly in the Catholic health care system, where that can become an issue. I talk at length, actually, in my book. I have a chapter called sort of Dialogue of the Deaf, which is the issue of abortion, because it seems neither side can hear the other side. But I guess that's what I would say.
But the Seventh-day Adventist, is there something specific that we were thinking of? There's nothing in Seventh-day Adventism.
No. When I talk about Seventh-day Adventists in my book, it has to do with a court case having to do with sort of the right to practice religion. It actually wasn't anything having to do with faith healing.
Okay. Again, Rick, thank you so much for making that call then. 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard is our WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com is our email address. That number again, 800-621-8890. Rita Swan, Paul Offit, Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. We are, as we talk about these issues of medical care or the conflict between religious belief and medical care, where can we go from here? Where would we need to go, Rita Swan, as an activist trying to change our society in its approach to such matters? Is there some one universal law, rule change you would like to see, perhaps in the state constitutions or in the United States Constitution?
Well, the United States Constitution has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court 70 years ago for a ruling that parents do not have a First Amendment right to abuse or neglect a child. The problem is that state legislatures give the religious objectors statutory rights that they don't have under the Constitution. And we have taken on our mission to repeal those religious exemptions so that all parents would have the same duty at the same threshold of seriousness of a child's illness to take a child to a doctor. We don't ask for the religious objectors to meet a higher standard, but we're just saying that they should be held to the same standard, the same point when a Catholic, a Methodist, a Jew, or an atheist would have a legal duty to take a child to a doctor. The religious objectors should have that same duty. Kentucky does have a religious exemption to child neglect, which we think is unfortunate. It says that a parent legitimately practicing his religious beliefs shall not be considered a negligent parent solely because he fails to provide specified medical treatment for a child. We believe this law sends a very bad message to parents, although, as Dr. Rosenthal says, if the child comes to their attention, they can get a court order for the medical care. But a law like that tells parents that it's a legitimate religious practice to withhold medical care on religious grounds and that they're not negligent when they do this. It could send a message to mandatory reporters that they should not report this because it says it's not child neglect. The law says it's not child neglect if they do. Kentucky also has religious exemptions from all the preventive and screening measures. Kentucky has a religious exemption from immunizations, even though children are put at much greater risk when they are unimmunized. They also affect other carriers. They affect other children around them. Kentucky has a religious exemption from metabolic screening of newborn babies, even though the metabolic screening detects disorders that cause terrible mental retardation or even death. So in those ways, Kentucky and many other states are saying these children are not as important to us as other children. And like you said, it's like a law that discriminates on its face. It's just as offensive to us as if there was a law saying that African-American children or Jewish children did not have the same rights as other children.
So I just wanted to jump in and say that this is a very fuzzy area, and that the lines between child abuse and medical neglect are often blurry, and they're often blurry to the practitioners that come across these cases. And so when we act as mandated reporters, and when we see a case of medical neglect or a case that we feel is medical neglect, we report it to Child Protective Services.
But, and that's mandated by what? By state law?
We are all, yes, we're mandated reporters. And it's also the theoretical principle, again, is the harm principle, in which we don't, if you see, an autonomous adult putting a third person in harm's way that would normally not make that decision or doesn't have the capacity to choose, that's sort of when we act. But it is up to the state to determine whether there's a case of medical neglect. That's the issue. So it's not, we can't, so what's frustrating for practitioners, and Dr. Offit can probably comment on this, we don't have the authority to make that call. We can call people in, call the state in, it can go to court, but we're acting as the child's advocate in the child's best interest. We use a best interest standard.
Let me get one final caller on the air very briefly. Larry from Louisville is on the line. Larry, go right ahead with your comment. We've got just about a minute for you.
Okay, I'll make it quick. Thanks, everybody. My wife is a pediatric neonatal nurse for 20 years. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'll make this quick. You were just touching on it, actually, but she works at a hospital that has a religious background, and she does protocol for drug babies, which we see more and more, and certainly in this area. And my question is, what do you think about the ethics involved in us, meaning society, getting a a baby that might be addicted to drugs off drugs because of the mother's actions, not off, or they're addicted to drugs because of the mother's actions. And then we call child protection and end up giving it right back to the same mother or family which has, you know, had that baby in that condition and not done anything to improve themselves.
Okay, Larry, we got your point. Let me ask Dr. Paul Offit to chime in here, and then we'll get Sarah Rosenthal. We're running short on time.
That's probably a question best for Sarah, but I'll give you sort of my last thought. I think Sarah said something earlier that was instructive, and it's our hospital too. If a Jehovah's Witness parent chooses not to give a child a life-saving blood transfusion, we could get a court order in an hour to give it. And the reason is because that's gone to the Supreme Court, and it's very clear. I think if a faith-healing case went to a Supreme Court, it's a case like Rita's, where, you know, where a child wasn't given back antibiotics for bacterial meningitis, if that went to the Supreme Court and it was clearly ruled that that was not okay, I think this would be a lot clearer, because this doesn't happen in other countries. It doesn't happen in Canada. It doesn't happen in England because the rules are much clearer there.
And Sarah Rosenthal, related to drug babies?
Yeah, so just related to that, that is a maddening situation. Nurses go through a lot of moral distress, which is when they feel constrained from doing the right thing. And, you know, there have been situations in lots of hospitals where nurses have even tried to adopt the babies. There have been ethics committee meetings, you know, to see what we could do.
And we're just about out of time. Does the hospital have the ability to take some action?
It's up to the courts. No, it's up to the courts and it's up to the state. And we often don't understand their reasoning, but it's a resource shortage. There's nowhere to place these babies.
Dr. Sarah Rosenthal of the University of Kentucky and the chair of the UK Medical Center Hospital Ethics Committee. Dr. Paul Offit, chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The author of Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And Rita Swan is the president of Children's Healthcare is a Legal Duty Child. And Rita, there's a website, and we'll post that information on our website so listeners can have access to it. Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Dr. Rosenthal.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Dr. Paul Offit.
Thank you.
Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. The program will be available, by the way, as a podcast within the hour on Thursday afternoon and repeated on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. Our producer for this week's program is Richard Turner, and associate producer Logan Riley. Technical director is Brian Bartlett. Julie Tennell has been on the phones. I'm John Hingsberg, and thank you for joining us for Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.